Piece by Piece, the musical theatre talk show podcast. Welcome to our episode of Spring Awakening, the Writers Edition. Our guests today are Duncan Sheik and Stephen Sater. But first, please welcome your host, Joe Bunker.
Hello and welcome to Piece by Piece, the musical theatre talk show podcast. I'm Joe Bunker, and as always, I'm going to be dissecting an iconic musical with the help of the most qualified of surgeons. Today, the show in question is the 2006 Broadway musical Spring Awakening. Based on the 1891 German expressionist play by Frank Wedekind, the musical version features book and lyrics by Stephen Sater and music by Duncan Sheik. It premiered off-Broadway in 2006 before transferring to the Eugene O'Neill Theatre, where it garnered incredible reviews and went on to win 8 Tony Awards, as well as a Grammy for Best Musical Theatre Album. Now, lately I've been working on the London revival of Spring Awakening, which explains why things have been a little bit quiet on the podcast front of late. Apologies for that, but I'm thrilled to say that today, we have both writers of the show here as my guests, joining me via Zoom from New York. So, let me introduce my first guest. He is a singer, songwriter, and composer whose studio albums include Phantom Moon, Daylight, White Limousine, and a self-titled album featuring the hit song Barely Breathing, which, when I last looked, had nearly 40 million streams on Spotify. He's composed the scores for plays, musicals, and film soundtracks. His stage shows include, of course, Spring Awakening, which won Tony Awards for Best Score and Orchestrations, but also Alice by Heart, also with Stephen Sater, Whisper House, an American Song Psycho, which before transferring to Broadway had its first outing at the Almeida Theatre in London, where Spring Awakening is currently receiving its first major London revival. It's Duncan Sheik. Hi, Duncan.
Hi, Joe.
How are you doing?
I'm really good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to see you again. It was all too brief, your stay over here.
It was. How's the show going?
The show is going really well. It's just amazing how audiences are responding to it.
It sort of raised the bar for my theater experience expectations.
Great piece of praise. And you've got a new production of Whisper House, which is on, as we speak, in America as well.
It is.
How's that going?
We just had the first preview last night. And I will say it's a very elegant version of the show. It's sort of the third time out with it. And I'm very pleased that I think that they've made this sort of lovely, concise sort of jewel box version of it. I'm really happy with Whisper House. But, you know, we're in previews, so there's a little, you know, there's work to do.
Always. Well, it's great to have you here. My second guest is a poet, a playwright, a screenwriter, and a lyricist whose work includes collaborations with pop artists, including Michael Bublé and Bryan Adams, as well as the book and lyrics for Spring Awakening, which won him Tony Awards for Best Book and Score. He collaborated with Duncan Sheik on the album Phantom Moon and numerous musicals, including Alice by Heart, for which he also adapted a novel. His musical Some Lovers, featuring music by the legendary Burt Bacharach, was released as an album in 2021 and is currently in contention for the Grammys. It's a man of many hats, Stephen Sater. Great to see you, Stephen.
Hi, Joe.
Congratulations on your Grammy nomination.
Thank you.
Of course, you both have already won one for Spring Awakening. Do you want to tell us a bit about Some Lovers?
It's been a real labor of love for many years. I've been working on it with Burt, which is, you know, the thrill of a lifetime. The show's been through a number of incarnations and was on its way to, we thought, a series of regional productions leading toward a potential limited run on Broadway. And the pandemic struck, as it did so many shows. And we had the idea of doing a concept album, even though we had no concept for the album. But I'm really proud of the result, and it does mean most to me for Burt, who's 93, and it's something for his legacy. That's how I see it.
I, for one, like the idea of a non-conceptual Broadway album.
A non-conceptual concept album.
That really works for me.
I love it. Now, lots of people are going to know you guys from your work on Spring Awakening, but your partnership goes back a long way, right? And it encompasses studio albums, on a play, and numerous musicals. So take us back to the start. Tell us, how did it begin? How did you meet, and how did this amazing creative collaboration start?
It was shortly after New Year's 99, so I guess that was, 23 years ago. We're both members of the Soka Gakkai International, which is a lay organization. It's a Buddhist organization. I came to Duncan's house to chant with him, and neither of us had any agenda except to chant. And I think for me, it was like the meeting of a lifetime. and my life really turned some mystic corner that night. That night, I went home and faxed Duncan a lyric. We faxed in those days. A lyric from a play I was doing, and he said it verbatim. And that's how we began. We were writing songs, and I had this bug, and I began sending him lyrics, and he set them. And then Duncan proposed at one point that we do an album together, which became this album, Phantom Moon. And it, as we were working on that, Duncan came to see the show for which he'd written the songs, and I said, which was called Umbridge at the time. I said, we should create a piece of theater together. My version of this is. Duncan made a face and said, musical theater. And these may be my words for it. But he said something to the effect of, if he were going to work on a musical, he'd want the music to be relevant to the culture at large. And the moment he said it, I just thought of Spring Awakening.
Wow.
You know, as you know, I'm kind of a literary guy, so that's what I think of first. The play, the original play, the 19th century play you mentioned, is so full of the unheard cries of young people. And then it seemed that the place for generations that young people had sought release from and found expression of those same yearnings was in rock music or folk music, pop music. So that's how we began. So it seemed like a great fit to the show.
Yeah.
So that was in 99 we began work.
And how long did it take then to get from the initial idea or the kind of first inspiration through to a full production?
8 years, 7 years, 7 years, from 99 to 2006. So it was 8 years till we won the Tonys. I'll tell you a bad story, but I'm going to tell it because Duncan remembers it too. We were nominated for 11 Tonys, and we won eight. It was the night of our lifetimes. I know I keep saying it's not, but it was a huge event. And we were on the stage somehow after the ceremony, and my son came by. I don't remember how I said this to my son, but I said, my God, it was 8 years and eight Tonys. And my son said, too bad it didn't take 11 years.
Oh, children.
And said in the most dry, deadly delivery, too.
Wow. They really know how to keep your feet on the ground, hey?
It was cold.
So, Duncan, how would you describe the musical language of the show? Was it always obvious to you what the show would sound like, or did it take a little while to find that tone?
Okay, well, so I think Stephen will remember that there was a sort of very initial conception, which was probably, we talked about it for all of 15 minutes, but there was this initial conception of it being set in like McCarthy era America. And therefore it would be sort of like rock and roll, you know, like, oh, we'll do like, you know, early American rock music, you know, as the sort of form of rebellion in McCarthy era America, which, you know, it makes sense, on a few different levels. But for me, the issue was like, I don't particularly like 50s rock and roll music. Like I most of it, I feel like is just unsophisticated. And I, you know, for me, rock music gets interesting when it gets more sophisticated. And that's why I'm such an Anglophile, because it's like all the, you know, the Brits managed to do that. But I digress. So, you know, at a certain point I was like, look, you know, I feel like if I'm going to be able to sink my teeth into this project and into this story, I'm just going to have to write music that's in the style of the music that I enjoy and that I do. It needs to be authentic to sort of my own aesthetic tastes. Folk music, a la Nick Drake and John Martin and maybe some, you know, American counterpoints of those guys. Electronic music, sort of in the way that Radiohead had begun to become sort of more of an electronic band from an alternative rock band, or Bjork, for example. And then alternative rock, you know, people like Jeff Buckley and his ilk. And then 20th century classical music, so Arvo Pärt, Steve Reich, John Adams et al. And those were sort of the four touchstones that seemed like the interesting places for me to to sort of write music for Spring Awakening. I think people perceive Spring Awakening as a sort of rock musical because
right.
there's things like Totally Fucked and Bitch of Living that are very high lit just because of how they happen in the show and that energy. But there, you know, there always was this sort of spine of, you know, of sort of electronic music, certainly maybe even more so in the demos, but it's still there in the show. And, you know, and then, of course, there's this folk aspect and there's this sort of 20th century, you know, minimalist classical music thing that's in there. That's just, you know, because those are the things that sort of inform my harmonic sensibility. Yeah. And then added to that sort of Simon Hale's really brilliant ability to sort of elevate, you know, some of my ham-fisted harmonic ideas and turn them into something really well-crafted.
So for the purposes of listeners who might not know, Simon Hale did the string arrangements, the string orchestrations, and what an incredible job he did. And he's done some new arrangements for this production, even with incidental music that we like said, oh, it's going to be 8 bars of this, and we were just sort of busking it in rehearsals. And then he comes back with these orchestrations, that's incredible, you know, complete narrative art. And you think, how did you get that from what we scribbled down? Smart man, good man to collaborate with.
Very good man in a storm.
Yeah. And I've been thinking a lot about how the songs in this show function within the drama. Because I suppose it's quite unusual the way they operate in this show. It's certainly different to what I guess we'd think of as like the Golden Age Broadway book musicals. So Stephen, do you want to talk a little bit about how the songs function within the drama and whether there was always a plan for that or whether that was something that maybe changed as you were working it through?
That was an idea that came right away. It was part of the conception of the piece from the beginning. It was actually the second or third call I had to Duncan when we were first talking about the show. I just remember the call, you know, it's where I was standing on the street when we had it. Duncan had said, when we had been talking about musicals, Duncan had said he really hated in musicals when people are talking and then they're singing and they're talking. It seems almost arbitrary what they're singing about, what they're talking about. And I agreed. And I thought about it, and I think the two sources I thought of were Shakespearean monologues, soliloquies, which I thought about a lot when I was sitting in rehearsal at the Almeida, where I had just seen Macbeth, I'd seen Richard III, I'd seen Hamlet multiple times. That the songs could invite you into the inner life of the singer, of the character. And then I thought of internal monologues in 20th century fiction, you know, like James Joyce sitting right here, Virginia Woolf. There seems something really evocative to me about the songs participating in what we can't say, what we may not know or we may be unwilling or unable to voice, that a young, if you look at the word of your body, how it functions now, that there's this young man and young woman are meeting in 19th century Germany. There's very little they can say. There's touch, there's electricity. It's the Walt Whitman feeling of to touch my person to another's is about as much as I can stand. It's just like almost more than they can handle. And underneath, they have this premonition of something profounder. But what that something is, which is the subtext of the scene, is you're going to wound me. I'm never going to get over this. I'm going to carry a wound. And oh, I'm going to wound you. Mm-hmm. It's not just like I'm falling for you. It's this profound, dark sense of their destiny together and a kind of inevitability of their loves together. And I don't know. It just felt rich and poetic that the songs would sort of explore or sort of continue to develop this theme of how we're essentially isolated as human beings, how we are unheard. Mm. I mean, if the great theme of this play to me from the 19th century was that we're not listening to what's going on in the hearts of our children, you know, if this one is an indictment of the moral imbecility of adults, what better way to express that than to allow the children, really to say, you know, almost a literal way, that they could not be heard, that what's in our hearts cannot be heard by anyone else. I think the last thing I would say, and I know I'm piling on literary references here after Duncan piled on his musical references, but this is what you're getting from us. I think had I not known Greek tragedy as well as I do, there would be no Spring Awakening, because I looked at Greek tragedy as another way in which songs could function in a story.
Okay.
In other words, the classic rule of Golden Age musicals is references that the songs further the story, they further the plot, the lyrics further the, you know, the action of play. I never like that. That always makes me uneasy to see people advancing a story in the song. So if our songs were going to function in an interior way, we still wanted to have group numbers. We still wanted energy. We still wanted an explosion of life musically. I thought that youth is like a house on fire. Adolescence is like a house on fire. And these kids can be like the chorus is in a Greek tragedy, where they're voicing a communal feeling. And the same way we go through high school together or college together, and I'm the class of 92 and you're the class of 2001, you're bonded to those people of your year and your life and your experience, that we could look at the vocal numbers, which are, you know, ensemble as choral, so that when they're all singing The Dark I Know Well or The Bitch of Living, yeah, they can voice their own aspects, but they're also extensions of the people whose song it is. And Then There Were None is a great example.
Yeah.
They're, it's Moritz's song. Moritz is the one having this experience. Moritz is the one spinning out of control with this letter that he's received from Frau Gabor. But the other boys sort of appear as parts of his psyche.
Yeah.
Which is very expressionist, actually. It's very like what Vatican does in the graveyard scene. But they egg him on and support him in those feelings. But their voice is within him, in other words.
Yeah, and there's another aspect I was thinking about in terms of the songs, apart from this thing about the characters not necessarily hearing each other, but all kind of communally having a solitary individual experience, is that so often the characters sort of don't sing directly about their own experience. They don't say, I feel sad, I would like to do this. They sing about something that's just at one remove. Like, I love the fact that in the funeral sequence in Left Behind, Melchior isn't singing about his own grief directly. He's imagining what, you know, Herr Stiefel's grief is like, how it's feeling for him. And when Wendla finds out that she's pregnant and she has a confrontation with her mother, she doesn't sing about what she's feeling right now, but she makes that connection with the ghosts in the past and these women who have come before her and the ones still to come. And was that something that you were always thinking about when you were writing, were there ever versions of these songs which were more kind of straightforward, I suppose?
No. I mean, I have to just say honestly, I've always been more drawn to poetic expression. Duncan and I shared that sensibility. Confessional poetry is never my thing. I just don't like it very much. You know, Rupert said to me...
Just in case it's not clear, Rupert is Rupert Gould, the director of the London revival of Spring Awakening.
He was talking about Ilsa. He loves the character of Ilsa, but he said what's so unsettling, what's so sad about watching her is that she seems only to express herself by these objective correlatives. A field of wheat, of hay, of books lying on the grass, that's kind of where she lives. And then only at that last beat does she say to Moritz, you know, by the time you wake up, I'll be lying on some trash heap. That she's completely aware of the tragic circumstances she's in, but it's not what she has to voice. And it's not what her songs have to voice.
Yeah. What's that phrase you use? Objective correlatives.
Objective correlatives. Yeah. It's Rupert cited to me. We were, you know, we did work, as you know, on The Dark I Know Well, the lyrics of The Dark I Know Well. It was in an email he sent me about Ilsa. So yeah, it's a phrase from T.S. Eliot describing how poetry works. Eliot uses it to talk about poetry when you, like when I say the notepad looked dour. The candle had aged so much it was guttering out. So it's an image of the man sitting at his desk, or whatever it is, you know. The image expresses it. So its object is a correlative to the inner feeling.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And was that a challenge for you writing the music, Duncan, this idea of writing ensemble numbers for people that aren't necessarily singing together, or was that something that came quite naturally?
Honestly, when I was writing the music for Spring Awakening, it was the first time I was writing music for a musical. It was the first time I was writing music for another person's lyrics. So I had always written my own lyrics, you know, in my long four-year career up to that point. I wasn't thinking about all the, you know, the sort of the things that were to come in terms of the idea that this would be, you know, 15 different characters, you know, in a multiplicity of scenarios. It really was, you know, okay, here's the lyric, and it just, there wasn't even characters written there. It was just like a lyric. So I would just write a demo as if I was writing, you know, one of my own songs, but with somebody else's much more poetic lyrics, which was fantastic for me because I, you know, Stephen and I always had this kind of inside joke, and I don't mean this as a slight to Billy Joel because he came to Spring Awakening and he was a really lovely guy, but we had this, we sort of have this inside joke about, you know, doing the Billy Joel musical where everything is just completely literal. It's like, yeah, Uptown Girl, you know, or I'm moving out, you know, and the yeah, packing up and moving out, you know, whatever. So to me, you know, it's just so much more compelling when there's just a poetic expression of an idea. You know, it can hit you in these sort of strange, complex, enigmatic ways. You know, direct sort of lyrical expression of ideas just doesn't do it in the same way. It's sort of my big gripe about pop music generally right now. It's just like things are just so direct and mm-hmm, just so like, oh, you know, we went to the club or you didn't call me back on the phone or what, you know, like that, you know, to me is, it's only going to get you so far in terms of a depth of feeling.
And I suppose the sort of received wisdom is that song lyrics should be immediately kind of understandable and comprehensible because you don't get us. It's not like you mentioned T.S. Eliot earlier on, Stephen, and like T.S. Eliot, you can read a dozen times and still have a million questions about what he's trying to say. Does it ever kind of worry you that actually maybe people aren't picking up the meaning? Or I'm just interested because on paper you go, well, actually poetry as song in a theatre setting shouldn't work, but it is really effective. So I'm just interested as to whether that's ever been a sort of bone of contention or something that you've worried about, just people actually getting enough information on first viewing.
It's something, if we want to talk about Stephen Sondheim, who is certainly the great proponent of you understand lyrics the first time through, it's something I had a couple of arguments with him about that. Not that you asked about him, but I'm going to just say it because I know Duncan feels this too in his own way, his own experience. He was so generous to me. He invited me on panels on lyric writing like a couple times. He would reach out to me, and we were so categorically opposed in our views of what what lyrics should be like. So that's why I appreciated him. But that said, he said it in a written way, but he said to me in person, there's just no way an audience has to understand what they're hearing the first time because they're not going to hear it again. And I said back, no, you want to leave them wanting to hear it again. Yeah. Yeah, that's the purpose of it. I mean, but I've never, ever engineered something to be enigmatic. I've always, you know, to this day, people ask me, what's a purple summer? And I can answer. In other words, that I can't necessarily resolve their problem with it, but it's not arbitrary.
Yeah.
To me, it's expressing something true. And you've read the lyric book, haven't you? The little yeah, book about the lyrics. You know, there are a lot of references. A lot of thought has gone into the lyrics. So they're expressing a truth. That said, I do... And Duncan knows this well. I do revise the lyrics a lot, and often Duncan and I are more attached to original versions. But it does come out of sometimes the needs of a scene, but also like I often remember, it was maybe the end of the Atlantic Theater run. It was, and Michael Mayer had a friend who had come to see the show, and he had a few people he would invite, and then whatever they said became the gospel of what we needed to do for the show.
Right.
So it was like that. And I say that with all love and appreciation because we did improve the show. But this one friend, also a book writer, said to him, Michael said something about The Mirror Blue Night, and he said, oh, that song I love and I don't understand a word of what it means. And I did look at it, and I can listen to Duncan's demo of it, which I have, and I can listen to the current version, and I think I improved it. I simplified it. I made it clearer. The object is not to dumb it down, not to reduce the level of poetry about it, but allow it to be somewhat more accessible. And there are lyrics like Mama Who Bore Me that are just exactly what I first gave Duncan. Hmm. And there are a number of those. Totally Fucked Us That Way Too. But there are others like Mirror Blue Night, like Touch Me was one of the... Well, you can hear on the cast recording the differences in Touch Me and Purple Summer.
Yeah.
So there are changes. There are only men with golden fins, the women with them, swimming with them to shore. You can understand that image, but I made it more, you know, it became more personal to the characters, or to the, not to the characters, but to the situation of wanting to be touched, wanting to be kissed, imagining someone's lips there.
Yeah.
So that's the challenge, is to keep the bar where it is, but to allow people in a bit more and allow it to fit the context more. The same way you continue to refine musical arrangements or dialogue and scenes.
And we were talking a little bit about the songwriting process just now, Duncan, and I wonder whether it's worth just talking about Anne-Marie Milazzo and her work as a vocal arranger, because her work is so fascinating and brilliant. I just wonder what your collaboration with her was like. Or did you just send her the songs, or was it a kind of back and forth?
No, it was pretty much me just sending the songs, and she does her thing. Neither of us really write music on the staff. You know, we don't deal with lines and dots at all. So she like me, just sort of records things, and it just, they sort of come out of her head, and she'll make multi-tracks, you know, versions of vocal arrangements that she just sort of sings herself, and then they get transcribed. So in a way, we have a, you know, I don't want to say similar process, but we have similar shortcomings. you could argue that that's why we both sort of have our own unique voice, is because we're just sort of operating in our own operating system. And what she came up with and comes up with is always awesome. She's really great at what she does, that's for sure.
I think we have a lot of fortune, Joe, on this score, that we have geniuses. I mean, starting with Duncan, but to have Simon Hale on these arrangements and to have Anne-Marie on these arrangements, it's astonishing. I mean, Michael micromanaged that stuff a lot, you know.
Michael Mayer.
Yeah, yeah. He did micromanage stuff. I mean, in terms of like which, like Anne-Marie was only allowed to do so many songs. And then she had to, I remember Anne-Marie had to fight with Michael, and she'd say, I want to do some of Purple Summer. And he would say, you could do this much of Purple Summer. So Michael managed her in a way. But she just brings that stuff in. And when we have this, what Duncan's talking about, that he records the demos, and they sound beautiful, though they're just simple demos. And then she puts them into GarageBand and sings over them. So they sound kind of awful in terms of things to give people. They do. But they're genius. And then the way they manifest when you teach them to singers, yeah, she's really a wonder.
I love some of the notes that she sent through for us in this production. I love that note she said about the start of Touch Me. The backing vocals are not so much singing as an effect, like wind. And I thought that's so beautiful. I mean, you hear that and you go, oh, of course that's what it is. It's just a breeze blowing through the window. I wanted to ask about some of the changes that you made to the play. I mean, obviously structurally there's huge changes, but a lot of the narrative is kind of honored, and but certain things are very substantially different. You added in the classroom scene at the beginning, because in the original play, you never see the children actually at school. You see them outside and on, you know, in the woods or on the way home, but you don't see them in the school. And then at the end of Act 1, and as it is in the musical, and the end of Act 2, there are huge changes in the Act 1 hayloft scene with Melchior and Wendla. That scene is not consensual sex in the play. It's a rape scene, right? Was that a given that you would have to change the nature of their relationship and make it a romance, or did you tussle with it?
No. It really was, from the beginning, I was really the resolute one about staying faithful to Wedekind. Michael would be, oh, this is problems, you can improve this. Duncan and I were going on our journey musically. Wedekind's great play is really the most scabrous indictment ever written of adulthood. But it's the brunt of it is social. When we added songs to these characters, what I found in the kinds of songs we wrote, these internal discourses, you went into the hearts and minds of the characters in a way you don't in the original play. It's not a criticism of the original play. It's just not the kind of play it is, where you're rooting for Melchior or rooting for Wendla. They're different. They're in a big landscape of, you know, existential desire and despair. What we found, having introduced those songs and taking us into the minds of hearts of the characters, is you wanted to go on journeys with them. And so we began creating this new thing, which was a musical, to want to arc the characters into a journey. The classroom scene, we wanted to see what the context of these boys' lives are. Well, Michael was pushing for an I Want song. There were two iterations of that song. I was just, one was called Is This Living? One was called West of Words, which ended up in Alice by Heart. But so there was crafting of that I Want. There was a crafting of a moment to set Melchior on his way and to feel like he could crack the world, he could solve it with the power of his mind. But the other crucial component of that scene for me was that Melchior stands up for his friend. Then we're really with Melchior, because he's done that, and we're sympathizing with Moritz, right? The other change, by the way, we skipped over, I know you're aware of it, but that scene with Wendla and her mother, which is the opening scene, that Wendla, in the original play, Wendla asks her mother how babies are made after she's been raped and beaten by Melchior. So she doesn't lead with that. I thought if you put that front and center, you're creating a cautionary tale about lying to our children. The show then staged during a period when our whole country was being lied to about a war. We learn in Touch Me that Melchior is interested in how to give a woman pleasure, and that he honors that, and he knows how much that means. Why would we want to see that boy rape that girl? It's not what he's interested in. He wants to give her pleasure. He wants to experience pleasure. He thinks he understands sex. He thinks he's above it. He falls. He can't conquer the world with his mind. He meets this girl who throws everything haywire in him. So he succumbs. He gets out of control himself. But also, let me just say, in terms of the book, the scene right before that, in the end of the first act, which is one of my favorite scenes of the show, is Moritz's scene with his dad. We never see that dad in the original play. We see him at the funeral. There's so much craft went into creating the arc of these characters and the storytelling for our musical. And I do think that there's a common sense that we kind of took the play and added songs to it. Mm. You know, Wedekind wrote the book, we wrote the songs.
Yeah.
It's really not that. It wasn't an 8-year journey of getting the songs right. It was creating this musical. And everything you change changes everything else, just like in every other musical. Whispering was the last lyric we changed. And it was because she felt like a victim. So she could be empowered. So she could claim what she had done. She could say, you know, she used to say another summer story. Now she says, let that be my story. So anyway, those were some of the changes.
And then, of course, there's the final scene in the graveyard, where in the play you see the sort of ghostly figure of Moritz back from the dead, who kind of encourages Melchior to take his own life, and this masked man who dissuades him from doing so. And in the musical, it's Moritz and Wendla as they appear in Melchior's mind. And was that something you workshopped? Were there variations on that as well?
We did. We had multiple versions of that, and multiple songs and multiple scenes.
We had the masked man in the show for a very long time.
And what led you away from that version?
We felt that the music already played the role of the masked man, that the music was what led the kids to embrace their darkness and lead them forward. And Neil Pepe said he wouldn't produce the show with the masked man.
Michael Cerver has asked for too much money, so we just...
So we figured it out. But also this does tie into my other answer, that we didn't want to see him betray his friend in the last scene. In the original play, he's purely a psychic projection of Melchior. He is in this mm-hmm. too, but he's a different guy. We've gone through his heartache and his struggle in a different way. And so why would we want to see him show up and convince his friend to kill himself? It just didn't make... You see what I mean? It had to do with the arcs of the musical characters we were creating. It wasn't about creating a happy ending. It's not a happy ending. It's affirmative. Melchior claims, I'm going to go on, but he's broken. He's bruised. He's been totally fucked.
Yeah.
If you think about the play of Spring Awakening and sort of the way it's operating and the way the characters operate in terms of what Wedekind intended for that show, they don't need to be sympathetic. They're all sort of exemplars of their time and place. Whereas I think I'm going to go out on a limb. It's, in a musical, you do need to sort of root for the characters on some level. Mm. I mean, Stephen, I don't know if you agree with that or not.
Well, we're working on this show about Nero, who couldn't be more corrupt. And part of the essence of that show is you can't resist him. He's so fucked up. He's so evil. But you kind of go with it. I certainly hope you do. And I think audiences do get behind those three characters in Spring Awakening.
Yeah.
And I think that is a big part of why the musical works.
It's really interesting that you guys met through Buddhism and through chanting. And I wondered what role, if any, your spiritual beliefs have on your writing. Because obviously the play and the musical is fairly excoriating about organized religion, I suppose, and the church and the way it's used to sort of hold children down. But it seems optimistic about the other world, kind of angels potentially, in a slightly different sense. I just wonder what your take on those things are and whether that feeds into your work.
I mean, for me, my sort of Buddhist practice, we don't traffic in the afterlife or anything about that at all. I mean, I think Stephen and I both love the idea of ghosts just as a machine in narrative and as an idea of memory and as a compelling machine to make a story work. But it doesn't have, you know, in Buddhism, they don't really figure at all. For me, where my sort of Buddhist practice or my Buddhist beliefs, such as they are, come into this, there's this idea of the 10 worlds. So I'm gonna just get a little specific for a second.
Mm-hmm. Please do.
There's hell, hunger, animality, anger, tranquility, rapture, learning, realization, bodhisattva, which is like compassion, and Buddhahood, which is like enlightenment. And these are the sort of 10 life states that as human beings, we're constantly shuttling in between them. And of course, you know, one hopes to spend more time in the higher worlds than in the lower worlds. You know, you'd much rather be in learning and realization than in anger and hell. But those are all aspects of the human condition. They always will be. They're not going anywhere. And for me, like really great works of art, they sort of express this idea that we all have this inside us, and in life we sort of all experience this incredible range of emotions and experiences that bring us to these places of great despair and great joy and great happiness and great pain and great pleasure. And so, you know, I feel like any great work of art, something like a musical that where you want it to have some scope, it needs to have all of those things inside it. And Spring Awakening certainly does. And so that, you know, that's why it can really sort of get behind it in a way, because it sort of expresses this truth about the human condition, that we have this incredible range of experiences that we're going to go through because we're human. And it doesn't shy away from the darkness, and it doesn't shy away from the joy and the light. And it tries to do that in a way that is, you know, I don't know, accurate, for lack of a better word. So that's where the Buddhism comes into it for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think that celebrating, you know, singing a song of purple summer could be seen as a Buddhist idea. It's affirming that we're of this world and we're of this earth, and that the world is transient and things pass, summers come and go. But there is a part of us that remains, that goes forward, that the new young come forward. You know, we're ever young, we're ever advancing, and life is transient.
And it's not explicit, and it's not prescriptive of Buddhism. It's just descriptive of life. And that's what's beautiful about it to me.
This show, you know, you just had this big 15th anniversary production or this concert performance in America. Do you ever grow tired of seeing the show, or do you find it still surprises you, or you learn new things, or does there come a point where you've seen it 10,000 times and you've sort of seen it all?
Listen, I have seen some productions that shall remain nameless that were sort of like a long two and a half hours. But honestly, what's great for me is when it gets reinvented in the way that Rupert and company managed to do. And it's like, you know, as a composer, you're sort of lucky because your music is pretty much protected, you know, that there's not that many changes. But so what you do get is this incredible whole different visual experience, you know, with it, with a different production. And so that's always really exciting for me to see that.
And I imagine the Deaf West production, which, for those who don't know, was a 2014 production which started in LA and transferred to a bigger theatre and then improbably went to Broadway. It wasn't ever intended to be on Broadway to start off with, but it ended up on Broadway and received 3 Tony nominations, including Best Revival. But it significantly, it featured both deaf and hearing actors performing together using American Sign Language, spoken English, and choreography to tell the story. And some parts had deaf and hearing actors playing the same role, kind of sharing it, one singing and one signing. That must have been amazing to watch. What was that experience like for you guys, seeing that, and were you involved as they were developing it, or did you just see it once it was made?
It was completely remarkable. And as we enter into Deaf West, I just want to say something about the larger question asking. Like, part of my friendship with Duncan, which has been so encompassing in so many parts of my life, it's been, and I know he'll remember this too, we show up at these events, like we're in the parking lot at the Annenberg Theater going to see Deaf West. It's like, here, we're going to see this again, you know? Come to London, let's see what's going, you know? It's remarkable how fresh and how exhilarating it can be. And Rent was all the rage when we were first working on the show, and we were urged to create, I was urged to do a modern version of it, a contemporary version of the show. Our first instinct had been, we were writing this 19th century show. We were doing, you know, the lyrics were kind of poetic. They were a little bit, you know, where they were, Purple Summer. But we were doing sort of a contemporary score. Then we were convinced to do this more contemporary version. We did a whole version of it. I mean, I wrote a script and Michael liked it. And then Annie Hamburger, who ran La Jolla Plaza at that time, who commissioned the show, said, this doesn't work at all. So we stuck to our guns for the years. And I'm so grateful we stuck to our guns, because what I feel when I show up at these productions is we created a more timeless lens. We created it by leaving it in period, by introducing the contemporary music, which we later realized, you know, played the role of the masked man. We created something that can be reinterpreted and recreated as a lens on the ever-changing present, as opposed to creating a period piece about the early 2000s, which this might well have become. Deaf West was completely revelatory to me. If there's anything at the heart of the show, as we said earlier, it's the idea that we can't hear what's going on in our children's hearts. Never has that idea come forward more profoundly, more exquisitely. This was the most startling scene to me, was the Latin scene. When the boys, Michael Arden, who directed it so brilliantly, drew on this technique of this fact of oralism, which is how 19th century deaf people were taught, and they were forced to vocalize, and they were denied access to sign language. And so you saw this boy, Moritz, not allowed his language, denied his language. So that was an early on scene, and you realized that sign language was verboten. So every song became another act of rebellion in a certain way, another part I can't tell.
Wow.
And the choreography was so beautiful. And it was the words, it was the sign language kind of made into movement. So it was a thrilling experience. Yeah.
Wow.
If you think about it, you know, the idea of doing a musical with deaf and hearing impaired actors for a deaf and hearing impaired audience, like on paper, that is a, I mean, talk about a non-conceptual musical. That's a terrible idea. But it ended up being so genius and so powerful.
And there's been talk for a long time about a movie version. Is there Is there anything you can tell us about that, or is it still a kind of work in progress?
That's what it is. It's a work in progress. I would say that we worked on it hard, and it looked like we were maybe going forward with it, and the pandemic has not been good to it, but it hasn't, but we're still going forward. I want to say something about Rupert. As you know, we replaced the Guilty Ones was The Once Was a Pirate. We've added two reprises of Mama Who Bore Me. I rewrote lyrics to The Dark I Know Well. There are new lines for the girls in the girls' scene. There's new lines for Vendla. These, I have to just say, there is no director in the world I would have made these changes for, except for Rupert. And it had to do with the trust I feel for him. It had to do with his insight into the material, his sensitivity, and his brilliance. The dance breaks and totally fucked.
Yeah.
You know, and bringing that up to the minute of youth activism around the world, it's extraordinary. It's really exciting to see such a new take on the material and how well it holds up, and that the changes he pushed for work. Not just that they work, like I wouldn't incorporate these changes, we wouldn't, you know, and we're not gonna replace the Guilty Ones with The Once Was a Pirate, this is this production. I don't think we would incorporate the reprises, but that everything came together as being of a piece.
Yeah.
Like it's a moment in the history of the original play, I think, is this production.
Wow, that's high praise indeed. I'm endlessly fascinated by these young actors that we have. I just think they're remarkable.
They are just, you know, off the charts. Exciting to watch them. And again, it feels just so fortunate that we have such a cool group of kids doing this show. Amazing.
They're super cool. They make me feel very, very old.
I didn't say that, but I...
Welcome to my world.
My friends, that is all from us. So huge thank you to my guests, Stephen Sater and Duncan Sheik. This has been Piece by Piece, Spring Awakening.
That's the end of Piece by Piece, Spring Awakening, the Writers Edition. But don't worry, we've got music, chat and quiz action to come in our two-part Spring Awakening episode with the Almeida production cast and creatives. Our guests today were Duncan Sheik and Stephen Sater, with thanks to Elizabeth Siegel. Piece by Piece is devised and presented by Joe Bunker and produced and edited by Nikki Davison for Auburn Jam Music. Our theme music is by Ben Cox, and our executive producer is Blake Klein for Pint of Wine. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at @PBP_podcast or email us with your thoughts, piecebypiecetalkshow@gmail.com. Thank you for listening to Piece by Piece. Do join us again.